Welcome to Psych Ready, the podcast that gets you exam ready for OCR A-level psychology. I'm your host, and today we're diving deep into one of the most important research methods topics on the specification, observations. Whether you're sitting component one this summer or just getting started, this episode will give you everything you need to pick up marks confidently. So grab your revision notes and let's go. Section one, what is an observation and why does it matter? An observation, in psychological research, is a method where a researcher watches and records behavior directly, rather than asking participants to self-report through questionnaires or interviews. The key advantage is ecological validity. You're capturing what people actually do, not what they say they do, and that distinction matters enormously in psychology because human behavior is notoriously inconsistent with human self-report. Now, OCR examiners want you to understand that observations are not a single thing. They come in different forms, and the choices a researcher makes about how to conduct their observation are what we call the observational design. There are three key dimensions to that design, and mastering them is your first priority. Section two, the three dimensions of observational design. Let me walk you through each one clearly. Dimension one, participant versus non-participant. In a participant observation, the researcher actually joins the group being studied, they become part of the social setting. The classic example is a researcher joining a gang or a religious cult to study behavior from the inside. The advantage is rich, detailed, insider data. You get access to things an outsider never would. The disadvantage is that the researcher may lose objectivity. They can become so immersed that they start to identify with the group. This is called going native, and their ability to record behavior objectively is compromised. In a non-participant observation, the researcher remains outside the group. They watch, they record, but they don't interact. This maintains objectivity and reduces the risk of the researcher influencing behavior, but it means you might miss the nuances that only an insider would notice. Dimension two, overt versus covert. This is about whether participants know they are being observed. In an overt observation, participants are fully aware. They've given informed consent. The ethical advantage is clear, no deception. But here's the problem. Knowing you're being watched changes how you behave. This is called the observer effect, or sometimes the Hawthorne effect. Participants may act more socially desirably, which threatens the validity of your data. In a covert observation, participants have no idea they're being watched. The researcher might be hidden or might be disguised as a member of the public. The advantage is that behavior is natural and authentic. The disadvantage is significant ethical concern. There is no informed consent, there may be invasion of privacy, and deception is involved. Now, and this is a critical point that trips up so many candidates, overt and covert are completely separate from participant and non-participant. You can have a covert participant observation where the researcher joins a group without revealing they are a researcher. You can have an overt non-participant observation where participants know they're being watched by someone outside their group. These are independent dimensions. Do not conflate them. Dimension three, naturalistic versus controlled. A naturalistic observation takes place in the participant's natural environment with no manipulation of variables by the researcher. A child is observed playing in their school playground. Workers are observed in their actual office. The key strength is high ecological validity. The behavior you're recording is real-world behavior. The weakness is that you have no control over extraneous variables. Something unexpected might happen that confounds your data, and it's very hard to replicate. A controlled observation takes place in a structured, artificial environment where the researcher has manipulated certain variables. Mary Ainsworth's strange situation is a perfect example. A lab-based controlled observation where specific events were staged to elicit attachment behaviors. The strength is control and replicability. The weakness is lower ecological validity. Behavior in a lab may not reflect how people behave in real life. Section three, sampling methods. Event and time sampling. Once you've decided on your observational design, you need to decide how you're going to record data. You can't write down everything that happens. That would be overwhelming and impractical. So researchers use sampling strategies. Event sampling means you identify a specific target behavior in advance and you record every single time that behavior occurs. If you're studying aggression in a playground, you might record every instance of a child hitting, kicking, or pushing another child. You get a frequency count, a total number of occurrences. This is great for behaviors that are relatively rare or brief because you won't miss them. The risk is observer fatigue if the behavior happens very frequently. Time sampling means you record behavior at fixed time intervals, For example, every 30 seconds or every minute. At each interval, you note what behavior is occurring at that precise moment. You're taking a snapshot. This is useful for continuous or frequent behaviors because trying to record every single instance would be unmanageable. The limitation is that you might miss behaviors that happen between your intervals. Here's the exam trap. Candidates regularly confuse these two. Remember, event sampling is about counting every occurrence of a specific event. Time sampling is about recording what's happening at specific times. Event equals frequency. Time equals snapshot. Say it with me. Event equals frequency. Time equals snapshot. Section 4, behavioral categories and coding frames. To record data systematically, observers use a coding frame, a predetermined list of behavioral categories with precise operational definitions. This is where many candidates lose marks, and it's entirely avoidable. A good behavioral category must be three things: objective, measurable, and mutually exclusive. Objective means it describes an observable action, not an inference or interpretation. Acting aggressively is not objective, it's an interpretation. Hits another child with an open hand is objective. You can see it, you can record it without making a judgment call. Measurable means the behavior can be counted or timed. Vague descriptors like being upset are not measurable. Cries for more than 5 seconds is measurable. Mutually exclusive means the categories cannot overlap. If a behavior could be coded under two different categories simultaneously, your coding frame is flawed. Each behavior should fit into one and only one category. When you're asked to design a coding frame in the exam, always give the code letter, the category name, and a precise operational definition. For example, code A, physical aggression, defined as hitting, kicking, or pushing another person. Code B, verbal aggression, defined as shouting at insulting or threatening another person verbally. Notice how these are specific, observable, and clearly distinct from each other. Section 5, iterator, reliability. Once you have your coding frame, you need to check that it produces consistent data. This is where iterator reliability comes in. Iterator reliability refers to the degree of agreement between two independent observers coding the same behavior. If observer A and observer B watch the same footage and produce very similar data, the coding frame is reliable. If they produce very different data, there's a problem. Either the categories are ambiguous or the observers need more training. To measure inter-rater reliability statistically, researchers use Spearman's rho, a correlation coefficient. If the correlation between the two observers' data is above 0.8, that is generally considered acceptable reliability. Below that, the researchers would need to revisit their coding frame or retrain their observers. In the exam, when you're asked to evaluate reliability in an observation, you must use the phrase inter-rater reliability and ideally reference Spearman's rho. Generic statements like, the results might not be consistent, will receive minimal credit. Be specific. Section 6, observer bias versus observer effects, a critical distinction. This is another area where candidates lose marks through confusion. These are two different things. Observer bias refers to the tendency of the researcher to see what they expect to see, to interpret ambiguous behavior in line with their pre-existing hypotheses or beliefs. If a researcher expects to find high levels of aggression in a particular group, they may unconsciously code neutral behavior as aggressive. This is a threat to internal validity. It's a problem with the observer's perception and interpretation. Observer effects refer to the impact of the observer's presence on the behavior of the participants. If participants know they are being watched, they may behave differently, more carefully, more socially desirably, or more anxiously. This is a threat to ecological validity. It's a problem with the participants' behavior. So, observer bias is about what the researcher sees. Observer effects are about what the participants do. In the exam, you must apply these concepts to the specific scenario in the stimulus material. Don't just define them, explain how each one would affect the specific study being described. Section 7, ethics in observational research. Ethical considerations and observations are nuanced, and OCR examiners are looking for context-specific ethical evaluation, not generic statements. The key ethical principle at stake in covert observations is informed consent. Participants haven't agreed to be observed. However, the BPS guidelines do allow covert observation in public places on the grounds that people in public have a reduced expectation of privacy. So a covert observation of shoppers in a supermarket is ethically more defensible than a covert observation of people in their own homes. The right to withdraw is also relevant. In a covert observation, participants cannot withdraw because they don't know they're participating. Researchers must consider whether the potential scientific value of the study justifies this ethical cost. This is the cost-benefit analysis. Deception is inherent in covert observations and in some participant observations where the researcher conceals their identity. Researchers must consider whether debriefing is possible and appropriate after the study. In the exam, always link your ethical point to the specific context. If the stimulus describes a covert observation in a public park, don't just say, "Informed consent is needed." Say, "Because the observation takes place in a public setting, the BPS guidelines would permit covert observation without informed consent, as participants have a reduced expectation of privacy in a public space." Section 8, Exam Tips and Common Mistakes. Right, let's talk tactics. Here are the most important things to remember when you're in the exam room. Tip 1, in design of study questions, which are worth 12 to 15 marks, you must cover the who, what, where, and how. Who are your participants? What behaviors are you recording? Where is the observation taking place? How are you sampling and recording data? Examiners award marks for each of these components, so don't leave any out. Tip 2, when you justify your design choices, always link them to the context of the stimulus material. If the stimulus describes a busy classroom, justify time sampling by saying something like, "Given the frequency of social interactions in a classroom setting, time sampling every 30 seconds would be more manageable than event sampling, which would risk observer fatigue." Generic definitions of time sampling without contextual justification receive minimal credit. Tip 3. When evaluating reliability, use the phrase inter-rater reliability and mention Spearman's row. This signals to the examiner that you have precise methodological knowledge. Tip 4. Never write acting aggressively as a behavioral category. Always operationalize. Always give a specific observable action. Tip 5. Remember the three dimensions are independent. Overt does not mean participant. Covert does not mean non-participant. These are separate choices that can be combined in any configuration. Section 9, quickfire, recall, quiz. Okay, quickfire time. I'll ask a question, pause for a few seconds, and then give you the answer. Try to answer before I do. Question 1, what is the difference between event sampling and time sampling? Event sampling records every occurrence of a target behavior. Time sampling records behavior at fixed time intervals. Question 2. What are the three rules for a good behavioral category? Objective, measurable, and mutually exclusive. Question 3. What statistical test is used to measure inter-rater reliability? Spearman's row. An acceptable correlation is above 0.8. Question 4. What is the difference between observer bias and observer effects? Observer bias is the researcher's tendency to see what they expect. Observer effects are changes in participant behavior caused by being observed. Question 5. In what type of setting does the BPS permit covert observation without informed consent? Public settings where participants have a reduced expectation of privacy. Section 10, summary and sign-off. Let's bring it all together. Observations are a direct method of recording behavior, and they come in three independent dimensions: participant versus non-participant, overt versus covert, and naturalistic versus controlled. Data is recorded using event or time sampling, and behavioral categories must be objective, measurable, and mutually exclusive. Inter-rater reliability is checked using Spearman's row, and a correlation above 0.8 is considered acceptable. Observer bias and observer effects are distinct threats to validity, and ethical evaluation must be context-specific. If you can apply all of that to any stimulus material the examiner puts in front of you, you are in a very strong position for component 1. Thank you so much for listening to Psych Ready. Good luck with your revision, and remember, the difference between a good answer and a great answer is specificity. Be precise, be applied, and you'll get those marks. See you next time.